This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
We're leaving today and entering a world of Mickey Mouse waving, princess meeting and greeting,
lightsaber clashing, the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror dropping,
banshee flying,
Space Mountain launching,
galaxy rewinding,
what the necklace galaxy rewinding,
fireworks igniting, world of other worlds, for whatever you love. Infinite worlds await at the most magical place on Earth, Walt Disney World Resort.
Sierra has all the best active and outdoor brands for the super athletic stuff, like running gear for cruising up the trail.
Woo!
And the super athlete-ish stuff, like fishing gear for chilling by the creek. Nice cast. Fitness apparel to push for higher reps. You got this. And golf balls priced so you can afford to lose one. Or a few. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athlete-ish, Sierra's got it.
The new Chicken Bacon Ranch Street Chalupa is a Taco Bell. You can't get just one. Okay, so that's not like some marketing hyperbole. You literally can't get just one. They come in twos. So like, if you want just one, you're going to need to find a friend who loves slow-roasted chicken, bacon, and avocado ranch sauce. Or a friend of a friend, or have an awkward conversation with a complete stranger to see if they're obsessed with chicken, bacon, and avocado ranch. Or you could just like eat them both because you're obsessed with slow-roasted chicken, bacon. Okay, you get the idea. The new Chicken Bacon Ranch Street Chalupa is a Taco Bell. Participating Taco Bell U.S. locations for limited time while supplies last.
Believe it or not, turkey season is going to be here before we know it, and my favorite piece of turkey gear last season was the Meleagris turkey vest from XOP. It's got tons of storage for all my calls, extra shells, decoy stakes, and even a bird bag pouch to stuff a long beard in for easy carrying back to the truck. On top of that, I know you all had some gear that didn't work quite as well as you would have liked this last fall, so go check out some of the stands, sticks, and harnesses that they've got as well. You know my picks are the retrograde stand, the X2 sticks, and the super minimalist holiday harness. Go build your kit today at xopoutdoors.com. If you've listened to this show for a while, you know that if there's one tool I absolutely cannot live without, it's the Onyx Hunt app. I use Onyx year-round to mark spots, find new properties, access landowner information, and so much more. But throughout the year, I tend to use the app differently depending on what I'm doing. Right now, I'm always using it to double-check stream bank easements in the driftless. And when I'm not doing that, I'm using the slope angle layer to look for pinch points or little knobs that a buck might be betting on. And of course, when I'm in the field scouting, the tracker feature is running at all times to paint a picture of how things move throughout a property. To learn more about all the other features that Onyx offers, head over to onyxmaps.com. We all know there's nothing worse than being cold and wet while you're trying to pursue your favorite game. That's why I trust Huntworth with all my hunting outerwear needs. This past fall was the warmest and driest I've ever been throughout an entire hunting season, and that's all thanks to Huntworth's Heat Boost technology and the DWR waterproof finish on their clothing. I've been wearing the Durham lightweight pants almost every time I hit the field, whether I'm chasing whitetails, busting brush for pheasants, or doing some postseason scouting. And you'd better believe that these things will be my go-to for turkey season as well, thanks to the waterproof seat and knee panels paired with the lightweight, breathable body. I'll probably rock the Grayling hoodie for the early season and eventually transition to the Fallon lightweight shirt when the hot late season starts. And all that's going to be in their Tarnan pattern, which I have absolutely fallen in love with over this past year. Go build your kit today at huntworthgear.com or visit the sporting goods section of your local Farm and Fleet or Fleet Farm to check it out in person. Southwest Wisconsin is home to one of the most unique trout fisheries in the country, with thousands of miles of spring-fed streams twisting their way through valleys, pastures, and prairies. And one of the best ways to experience this fishery is with a fly rod in hand. Good Chance Fly Fishing is your guide to all that the Driftless has to offer, whether you're an experienced angler or you're just looking to try something new and get into fly fishing. To find more info and book your trip, visit goodchanceflyfishing.com. If you've listened to this show before, I'm sure you've noticed that if there's one thing that keeps coming up over and over again, it's the importance of public lands and waters. Shoot, I'd venture to guess that 90% of what we talk about on this show takes place on public lands. We all love the challenges we face and the memories we create in these wild places, and we need folks who are in our corner to protect them as well. That's why we're proud to have partnered with the good folks over at the Wisconsin Chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. The Wisconsin BHA Chapter was formed to provide a voice for hunters and anglers throughout Wisconsin that want to protect our public land legacy, and everyone involved worked their tails off to protect public lands and access to those public lands and waters. To stay informed on all things public lands, the issues facing our public lands, policies that might affect them, and to cross paths with some of the coolest outdoorsmen out there, I highly encourage you to join the Wisconsin Chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, or at least the chapter of whatever state you live in. Also, be on the lookout for our Wisconsin Public Land Policy bonus episodes to keep you all in the loop on the legal side of conservation and how things get done here in Wisconsin. To join BHA, visit backcountryhunters.org/join, and to learn more about what's going on here in the Badger State, visit backcountryhunters.org/Wisconsin. What is going on, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of the Wisconsin Sportsman Podcast. I'm your host, Pierce Nellis, and this is your home for all things hunting, fishing, and conservation in the Badger State. Folks, I hope you're doing well, and welcome to the very first Wisconsin Public Land Policy episode. I've got Paul Shekelman here. Paul, how are we doing?
Good, Pierce. How are you, man?
Excellent. I'm excited for this one. So you are the policy chair for the Wisconsin BHA chapter, and correct?
Correct.
I should have confirmed the actual title officially, but so we've been teasing this for quite a while on some of our episodes here, but we are going to be diving into kind of just given the current state of things. We've all been seeing a lot of changes in things looking at federal land management and how things are going there. And obviously it brings up questions of, okay, well, if that's happening at a federal level, what's going on in my state at home? What do I need to know about? How can I get involved? So on and so forth. So that is why we've brought you in, is to shed some light on this and help folks, at least in today's conversation, we're just going to help folks learn a little bit about how things work from a procedural standpoint in the state of Wisconsin here, kind of who has the final say on changes, where did changes come from necessarily? And then, how does BHA come into play in terms of advocating? As we kind of talked about last week with our conversation with Sam Soholt, BHA, Howell, Sportsman's Alliance, these are all advocacy groups speaking on behalf of public land users and outdoorsmen. And so I'm excited for this one, man. Before we dive in here, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, kind of how you got to the role that you're in with BHA, as well as what you do outside of BHA?
Yeah, I would say I got involved with BHA. I just a big public land user, grew up surrounded by it, and to this day still hunt and fish on our great public lands in Wisconsin. But with BHA specifically, I liked what they were doing, got involved and was on the board, and it turned out that maybe because of my background in schooling and stuff, I was the only one that liked reading legislative documents and studies and budgets and talking to a lot of these people. So they said, you get to run this now. And so I've been dealing with the policy stuff, which has been great. It's been dynamic. There's a lot that's going on. The great thing is that everybody's just concerned. They just want to keep it good. And they come to BHA for, you know, an avenue to do those things and to be more involved and to advocate for what they care about. So it's a great role to be able to have and, you know, kind of steer what the ideal world looks like, what the real world's telling us, and how we can kind of find something that works, usually somewhere in the middle. So it's a fun role. But other than that, I hunt pretty much everything. I fish year round. We live in northern Wisconsin, so it's just a giant playground, which is a lot of fun. And I'm excited to be here and to launch this with BHA with you guys, Pierce. I think it's going to be a good thing, and hopefully keep the conversation rolling for people.
Absolutely, man. Yeah. And, you know, you're kind of in the perfect spot being up north there, where you do get, or at least you're close enough to a lot of the federal lands in our state, as well as, you know, dealing with some state lands and stuff as well. And
I think that's a really good point too, because, you know, I lived in Madison for a long time, and there is like a divide of like access and of opinion and all these other things between kind of the north and the south of the state. And it's nice to be able to like have lived both, mm-hmm. and to be able to approach it through kind of that way and hear about what's impacting communities up here and what's going on in the southern part of the state, and how do we, you know, ultimately just improve access and keep our state of wildlife and habitat at a high level for what it's known for. So I think it's good for people to get out of their bubbles once in a while and consider everything that's going on in competing communities at times, right?
Yeah, definitely. Well, especially, you know, it's one of the things we talk about all the time on this show is how diverse Wisconsin is, whether it be from an environmental standpoint or deer management standpoint, for crying out loud, to a political standpoint. You know, everything's there's a lot of contrast in our state. And, you know, especially being, you know, I'm from southern Wisconsin as well, you know, the Madison, sort of area. But, you know, as a lot of people know, the Madison area is very different than the northern Wisconsin area. And, you know, whether for a lot of different reasons. And so, you know, being someone who's got that, who's lived in and been around that contrast, like you said, gotten out of their bubble, and seen all sides of it, I think is a really good thing, and part of what makes you an asset to the chapter and the board. And
I'd say the one thing, even with all the contrast though, Pierce, is there's a couple common denominators, especially in our field, and one of the strongest is that people across the state of Wisconsin love to be able to fish and hunt and get out, you know, onto public lands. And we value that. We value, you know, our habitat and our environment and having a reputation of being a state that way. So we all want the same thing. It's just getting there is where the fun happens.
Yep, absolutely. And that's why we're having this conversation and why we're trying to shed some light on it, so that these conversations can hopefully get a little bit easier for folks listening. But so I guess to get things started here, how do things get done here in Wisconsin? And I guess, what does the process look like sort of from the bottom up or the top down, whatever makes the most sense from a, I don't know.
Yeah.
So whatever I can do to make your job easiest here.
It happens both ways. And sometimes it can happen fast and sometimes it's really slow. I think a good place to start is just like, you know, the NRB, the Natural Resources Board. You know, it's a committee that they're not paid. They get compensated for like travel and fees that they incur for their work on the board, but they serve 6-year terms. They're confirmed by the Senate. They're appointed by the governor, and they kind of set the policy and steer the ship for the DNR. So rules, any regulations, acquisitions, management plans, budget issues, it all kind of goes through the NRB. And it's been a contentious group at times, or, you know, from the public or even like legislatively. But, you know, I think I love history. It's good to remember where the NRB came from. And, you know, we didn't always have it. It was created back in 1967, I think it was, after this commission called the Kellett Commission was created under Governor Knowles. And it was part of a statewide like government reorganization, basically, like how they wanted to like retool different agencies and what they were responsible for. So, you know, part of that, you know, with the NRB being created was the DNR being created. You know, the DNR was not always what it is today. Part of this commission combined what was then called the Department of Conservation with the Department of Resource Development, I believe it was. And they merged that into now the Department of Natural Resources. So think back, you know, pre-1967, it was, you know, the conservation side. So fish, you know, fisheries, wildlife, and forestry were all being handled by one agency, and all the environmental stuff was on the other. And they had their own budgets. They had their own focus. There was a lot of places that they converged and their work like overlapped. But they were kind of separate beings before then too. So, you know, it's been over 50 years. There's been talk about, is that the better model to return back to? Like, would it be more responsive to stakeholders and to the users, to be able to have like two very, very like ultra focused agencies? And, you know, you think about like leadership and, you know, career opportunities in those two, like someone's path in the DNR might have been really focused on land management and wildlife, and they, you know, work up and all of a sudden they have to be in charge of like environmental stuff. Like, does that, you know, how often does that happen? We don't really know. Like, does that make the most sense? Not sure. I just know it's something that's been talked about a little bit more, but it's not abnormal. So I just throw that out there because there has been talk about it. Is how it used to be done in the state. Like, they were two separate things. So that's kind of the NRB. So again, the governor makes an appointment or a selection. The Senate ultimately, you know, votes and approves that person, and they serve for 6 years in a basically unpaid position.
Got it. Yeah, man. And there's a lot to unpack there. I don't want to speak for you here, but I remember a previous conversation you and I had on the merging of the conservation side of things and the environmental side of things being kind of a contentious point now that it's all under one umbrella. Is one of the things that some sportsmen are concerned with is, well, we all know that there's the tax on the Pittman-Robertson and the Dingell-Johnson tax that's being put towards managing our natural resources and everything, right? And you know, especially, you know, we all talk about tag sales and, you know, license costs and stuff like that, and we're going to get into that here in a little bit. But I mean, it's not uncommon for sportsmen to kind of look at things in terms of, well, our tags are paying for a lot of this land work. Why is that money being put towards maybe the environmental side of things rather than the, you know, conservation side of things? Is that accurate?
Yeah. And that's where it can get really confusing too, because of the way the funding and like the revenue is generated and dispersed, right? It's either attached as through GPR, which is your like a general fund, or it's called SEG funding, so segmented, and it's supposed to go towards specific things. So ultimately, most of your revenue is supposed to be going towards wildlife and habitat management if it's being generated by, you know, the hunting and fishing communities, right? Through PR, through Sportfish, through your fees and all of that stuff. I think where a lot of people are starting to raise these questions again, and again, like being on the policy side of BHA, like I do hear this a lot. It's not something I've just been reading in the old state history books and being like, oh, we should just do this again. It's just something that continually has come up. So we've spent a little bit more time looking at, and I think it really comes down to is just people are a little bit like frustrated or concerned about where things are going. You know, we have a ton of public land and it's the best, like it's great, but is it all being maintained? Like, do we have the resources to keep everything pristine and as we want it? And do we have the NGOs, you know, able to fill those vacuums? And do we have the money to do all this? And how do we get more of that if we need it? How do we make things better? Right. And when you come, you know, it comes time for certain seasons, if you go turkey hunting or bear hunting, or if you're fishing, you know, a lake you've fished your whole life, or deer season rolls around, you want to have a good experience. Mm-hmm. And if you're not having good experiences, you start to ask questions of like, what is going on? Right. Like that's if you're seeing everything, like the old timers always tell you, like back in the day, you would see this and that, and this was happening. well, you're not seeing that today. So it leads you to wonder what changed. And it might not even be like the agency issue and a focus issue or a funding issue. Maybe it's just how wildlife's adapting to, you know, more human interface and where developments occur and what the logging industry is doing now versus, you know, what it used to do then. And like so many things go into it. But again, it all, I think, stems from a place of this isn't as good as it was. Mm-hmm. And I really want it to be great again because I want my friends to have a fun time coming out with me, or I want my kids to get into this, you know. And again, that's like why BHA does so much on the R3 side, trying to keep people, like new people engaged or to get people back into it. But it's, you know, the big thing is providing a good experience. Like if you have a 13-year-old and you fish for, or, you know, you go fishing for 2 straight days or you're hunting for a week and you know, there's like no action, are we keeping that 13-year-old in, you know, or are they going to go do something fun?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing. So, you know, like really long-winded way of saying, like, I don't know that we know the specific answer of what would solve a lot of this yet. I think we're starting to figure some things out, but people are just kind of like frustrated with the state of where our wildlife and our habitat is, right? Like, and I hunt all over the place. Like, it's one of my favorite things to do is just to see how many counties I can go in or drop in. Like, you know, when it's archery season, I just have my stuff in my truck all the time. And if I'm driving back from Madison or Milwaukee or wherever, my Onyx is running constantly. Like, my battery doesn't last ever. but I might see something cool and be like, oh, I want to go check this out.
Mm-hmm.
This is cool. And if nothing else, it's just a hike and a new piece of public that I haven't been to. But I think, like, not this season, but the one before, I was in like 12 different counties, and some places are great and some it was like you can't get through this, like it is insane. Or like I'd be like, oh, there's got to be a ton of sign back here, and you'd get there and you're not even like seeing birds or like squirrels and stuff, and you're like, oh, that's weird.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's like a lot of it, Pierce, is just, hey, how do we make this better? What do we have to do? What does it look like? What did we used to do when it was good? And that's where people started looking backwards as far as, you know, those old photos of, you know, that all of our grandparents have of the buck pole or, you know, the string of walleye that you have to work so hard for now, you know?
Right.
And they're just wondering like, hey, that looks great. That'd be awesome. It'd be great for my kids. How do we get that back?
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Well, I want to point out one of the important things that you mentioned in there too. And that's just that a lot of this, you know, quite frankly, hunting's, especially in Wisconsin, we're a big tradition state, right? A big legacy state. And we want to have, you know, that those generational photos, you know, in the hunting cabin or the fish shack or whatever it may be of, you know, great grandpa, grandpa, you know, all, you know, the grandkids and stuff like that. We all want that. That's all like, I don't know, ingrained in our Wisconsin DNA. And, you know, one of the things you said there was just that there's a lot more than just, oh, the DNR didn't manage this, or, you know, like pointing a finger at the DNR, I guess, when we have to look at, okay, well, how have agricultural practices changed? How has development changed? I mean, shoot, Madison, like that area has exploded. Everything west of it is just going haywire when 20 years ago, not the case, right? And so, you know, taking a bigger, I guess, a bird's eye view at sort of things and kind of zooming out and looking at the whole picture in terms of like, okay, well, this isn't just a conservation issue. This could be a development or an agricultural, whatever. Type of an issue that it may be. So kind of circling back to how things get done here and stuff. So say there's a change, like let's use the, I don't know, the Sandhill Crane example, because that's kind of been on everyone's radar lately. But, you know, when it comes to actually making a change in legislation, you correct me here I'll give you two options here. Let's do either the Sandhill Crane option or the reduction of the panfish bag limit. Because one of them involves getting an entirely new season. Another one involves changing a regulation and stuff. So where does
let's do the Sandhill one, because that's kind of a great look into how things actually get done behind the scenes. So the sandhill crane hunting prospect has been on everybody's radar for a while now, right? Like, we have done a great job between the DNR and landowners and different NGOs and advocacy groups of, you know, how do we rehabilitate this species and in this flyway back to what it was. And I think at one point there was like only a couple breeding pairs left in the, in that flyway, like in the state, like it was dire. And so we, the DNR and these other groups and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife all got together and they started figuring out how to, you know, get this back. And they did. And it worked. It's a great conservation story, just like sturgeon and just like, you know,
all these eagles.
Yeah, that we've done a good job with, and turkey and, you know, a million things. But so when people start looking around, they're like, you know, this actually looks like a feasible thing again. I think we're there. You know, when it's a endangered species and a migratory issue, the feds are involved. So Fish and Wildlife, you know, had to review things and do their studies. And ultimately they said, yeah, you guys are good. Looks like you can manage it. If you manage it the right way, you can have a season. So there's like other organizations, like a great place to start is the Conservation Congress, right? Where the citizens elect delegates, like there's 300 some of them. And they kind of serve to advise the NRB and the DNR on policy. And so Sandhill Cranes, you know, and they do everything from like forward facing sonar to like environmental work. So it's a huge portfolio again, because it matches what the NRB is in charge of, which matches what the DNR is now in charge of, which is a huge, huge issue set. On the Sandhill side, so they, you know, Conservation Congress puts it on their questionnaire of what they're going to recommend to the NRB and the legislature. And that's one of them that's been on there for a while now. And it started gaining a little bit of momentum. You know, that's a great way to show buy-in from the people, that it's not just an idea from the top down. That's like a really good bottom-up way. Then groups like BHA can get involved and say, yes, we support this. And, you know, this fits our North American wildlife conservation model, you know, perfectly. Like, this is a great example of it. We should do this. And the legislature can get involved and make laws that supersede all of this, that say, yes, we're going to do this. And then they hand the authority over to the DNR to manage that. Right. So, you know, it can come just specifically from the legislature. It can come as a recommendation up the chain to the NRB and then have, you know, sign off from the legislature and the governor. So there's kind of all these converging things. But on the Sandhill front, it's interesting because, you know, this issue is one we've had to involve like everybody on, right? So it's your traditional like hunting organizations, it's the legislature, you know, it's trying to have discussions with the governor's office on it, you know, and there's other groups that don't want it to happen, and they get their fair, you know, shot at why it shouldn't be passed too. And that's a great thing. Kind of keeps things from swinging too far one way or the other. But the other side of this is we've had a lot of engagement with farmers, right? Like the Farm Bureau and these advocacy groups for agriculture, because, you know, sandhill cranes can decimate a lot of their crops. So now you have this pretty wide array of stakeholders all trying to get to a solution on one issue. And, you know, you can have things come up through the Conservation Congress. You can have it come through the NRB. You can have it come from the legislature as it is. And like I said, just kind of blanket things. But now I think we're getting to a point where there is like a lot of support for it, and through the bottom up, and hopefully through the legislature, we'll be able to get a hunt on the books here soon. Like, I don't know the timeline. Like, I know we're working with other groups on doing some educational work. And so everybody here should listen, you know, watch out for Pint Nights coming up with BHA. They're going to be focused on the Sandhill Crane, and we're going to be educating people with the Wisconsin Waterfowl Association on what it would look like, what the history is, you know, how we can do this the right way, what the benefits are, what some of the concerns are. And you get to hang out with like-minded people and join the cause too. So I think that's like a good overview of, it can come from a lot of different places, but it still typically takes a group to get things done, right? Like, you have to have buy-in and make it suitable for everybody involved, right? Otherwise you're going to have, you know, you might have a whiplash where it's not going to be lasting, or it goes too far one way and not the other. So that kind of gives a good overview of like, yes, hunters are concerned and there's a bunch of groups that are in on it. And when the Conservation Congress definitely helps by giving their like sign of approval, because that shows that like the greater delegation approves of this. But you still need the legislature and you still need the agencies and you need everybody to buy in to really get it moving.
Yeah, absolutely, man. And so you mentioned a couple of things there. The first I want to mention is the Pint Night, which I believe there's one coming up fairly soon at up in Stevens Point that's going to be geared specifically towards. Yep. Yeah. So that's going to be up. I wish I had the date for that. I should have been more prepared.
I should remember. It might be this weekend.
Oh, it might be this weekend. Okay. By the time this comes out, it might be too late, but be on the lookout for those. The other thing that I wanted to point out that is coming up for sure by the time this comes out is the annual spring hearing. And so you mentioned the Conservation Congress and everything, as well as the spring hearing. Those are two like just fantastic opportunities to voice your opinion on certain issues. The spring hearing is, I remember last year, I want to say it was like 80 pages or something like that. Like it was a doozy. And there's a ton of different stuff on there from, I mean, Sandhill Crane stuff, like we're talking about, the panfish bag limit, forward facing sonar, all this sort of stuff, all the way up to, I mean,
air quality, well water. Yep. Yeah.
100%. Yeah. Power boats and stuff like that, like wakeboards and all that action there, all that sort of stuff. So that's going to be April 14th, 2025 is when the actual, spring hearing is going to go, or I guess the survey goes out, and then your actual in-person hearings are going to be posted on the DNR website. If you just Google annual spring hearing on the Wisconsin DNR website, that's where you'll find all the information for that, as well as access to the survey. I think they email you the survey even, don't they? Yeah. So you should just check your inbox about a month from when this comes out here, and you'll be well informed there. And if anything, it's just interesting because, I don't know, from an outdoorsman standpoint, it's just, I don't know, we all like meat eater trivia and like trying to like having stuff that like makes us think a little bit. And yep. When you're posed with like all these different questions on the spring hearing, it's, I don't know, some of them are just fun to think about, for crying out loud.
Yes.
I hadn't thought about that. Stuff that's not on your radar.
Yeah. 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 You might not even consider, because again, like some people have like their niche thing that they're like, you know, I only gun hunt and I, you know, fish for trout, which is great. But that's like two things out of a ton, you mm-hmm. know, like there's people doing stuff in the woods that I've never experienced yet. And it's going to find its way onto this survey. So for some reason, right? Like there's just so many competing, I don't want to say competing interests, but just, you know, diverse opinions and again, solutions to what somebody viewed as a problem and trying to find a better end to it. So it's a great process, you know, even if you're just casually wondering what's going on in the world of Wisconsin conservation, mm-hmm. That's a great place to start. Again, cause like BHA, we touch a lot of that. We don't get involved in everything cause we can't, and that's not really like our role either. That's not like what we're here for, like really access and public opportunity. And then we go down the list from there and get involved in other things. So like, you know, probably a decent segue of some of the stuff that BHA is working on kind of behind the scenes right now, besides the Sandhill Crane Hunt, which we came out in favor of. But, you know, we're really trying to look at how do we unlock a lot of this like landlocked public land that's surrounded by private or you just can't really get to. You know, like what's a good solution there? I know it's been a forever problem, but we're like, you know what? We got to keep addressing it until it's not a problem anymore. I keep trying to pitch people and some of our like corporate partners that we should do one of those cool like fly-in hunts on one of them. Like we just gotta get somebody with a helicopter to drop us in on one of these pieces and we'll film it, do the whole thing, right? Like, because you can be there, you just gotta get there, right?
Right.
Like, so we're trying to figure out like, you know, how does BHA raise some funds? How can we work with other groups that can raise funds? How can we work with landowners to create easements and new opportunity, or like, you know, just like what's the best way? Like it's on the books. It's all of ours, but we can't use it. So mm-hmm. kind of view that as something we're going to continue to work on. And it's not going to be a fast solution by any means. Cause again, you talk about stakeholders involved and, you know, private property rights and everything like that. Like that's going to be a long road, but we've identified a handful that we think we have like a better chance of really opening up you know, hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of acres, you know, kind of in short order. But then we also came out in favor. We heard from a few people this last hunting season about some concerns with like disabled hunter transport, basically. So, you know, if you have a sponsor or somebody that's working with you to get you in and out of wherever you're hunting or fishing or recreating at, technically, by the way the law is written, even if you are a disabled hunter or whatever, you can't ride like on an ATV unless it's approved to be two person, even if you're going like 4 miles an hour and, you know, whatever. And they've tried to get that approved, and there's been like hangups with it here and there. Or like if you're going out ice fishing and, you know, just trying to go check a tip up, like technically that is illegal if you're not on something that's rated for two people, right? And you hope it's not like enforced super strict. Actually, I don't know if I can say that here, but the solution is they want you like on a sled behind the machine, like pulled by a rope. But I fail to see how that's like any safer than
right
the machine itself. So like we'll get involved in things like that because it just makes sense to us. And again, it's about improving access for people. And if there's public land, they have the right to recreate on it and they should be able to get there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, not something that we see a lot. It's kind of like a really focused issue, but again, people reach out to us and we're an avenue to try to make change. And that one made sense to us. So we're like, yeah, we're going to do whatever we can to make sure more people, you know, regardless of a function and ability or whatever, can hunt and fish our great public lands, right? Without you having to spend $20,000 on something that ensures you have a two-person capacity or whatever, right?
Right.
So getting on that. And then the Knowles Nelson funding will be coming up too. And we're obviously supportive of keeping that around, which I guess for your listeners, just so I'm sure everybody's seen or heard of Knowles Nelson, or you've seen the sign that says wherever you're hunting was, you know, partially funded by Knowles Nelson money. But that's the program that gives the DNR spending authority to purchase land and easements for recreating. It also goes into recreational infrastructure. So think like bathrooms, campsites, hiking, walking trails, boat ramps, kind of anything that has like a capital cost associated with it goes through Knowles Nelson. This year they're attaching like a habitat fund to it, which is interesting. And I think something that we should almost be doing as a standalone too, because Knowles Nelson gets a little heated at times. Like this year, the original plan is, or this year's plan is a 10-year extension for $100 million a year. So, you know, $1 billion when it's done in 10 years. Originally, when it was created, this goes back to 1998. Don't quote me. Under Governor Thompson is when they created this, just as a capital way to improve public land access in the state. And it's been a resounding success. Generates revenue, generates access. You know, people use a ton of it. But, you know, it's important to remember, again, as students of history, like the original one was 10 years for a total of $250 million. And again, costs go up, lands up, you know, building a bathroom costs a lot more than it used to. Fully get all that. But I did like seeing the habitat side because I think it's a really good idea. I've really been more focused on habitat lately. I think we've talked about this before, Pierce, where it's like, mm-hmm. sometimes you get to a place and you're like, yikes, what happened? You know, like the invasives took over, or
yep.
it's just not doing well. It's not regenerating, or there's like too much old growth and like the forest bed is dead. And you're like, I get it. It's got like an environmental function yet, I guess, you know, you could say, but well, you can't do much on it. Except kind of look at it. But, the habitat side, I think, would actually have a greater appetite politically too, is my personal opinion. I think you could get a lot more done maybe pulling that out. But we'll see what happens with it. Nothing in the budget is really going to start until after the spring election. So I know people are really amped up and kind of chomping at the bit waiting for things, you know, across the board with state budgets and funding. But we've got a little time.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. So I want to just ask you to shed a little bit more light there on the Knowles Nelson Stewardship Fund, just kind of how that works, where that money actually comes from. Is that a state funded program or is, okay, gotcha. So is that tax dollars going into that or how does that get funded? Got it.
So that's like a shared pot of money. And it's got to go to anything that it, like people can recreate on. So again, on the BHA side, we would prefer that every dollar spent of that is improving access to hunt and fish on public spaces. But it does go towards, like, again, campsites, county parks, like city parks, green spaces, that kind of stuff is technically available for it too. It's not necessarily like the biggest pool of money goes to there. Like, they're still looking at like large capital purchases of big tracts of land. But yeah, it's all tax money. And it's given to the DNR, and the DNR has the authority over figuring out what they're going to buy and kind of where. And then, you know, the legislature will get involved in that, like they have in the past, on if there's like local concerns or if there's any kind of disagreement with something, they'll definitely voice their opinion or maybe get involved in where the money's going. But typically it grants, like, again, some capital costs of like actual infrastructure. But a lot of it's for land and easements itself. So been a really successful program. It's been around a long time. It's not guaranteed. And I think some people get confused with that part where it comes up as far as, oh, they're trying to get rid of this thing that's like part of law. It's not like that's why they shoot for these like 10-year, you know, renewals of capital funding for it, because it's not guaranteed. It's just been for a program we've been running since Governor Thompson. So, you know, and how it's spent, that's the part where people can kind of get a little more interested or less interested in it too, because, you know, here's a great example. Like, you live in Southern Wisconsin. And when I used to live in Madison, there is public land, but not a ton of it. And I fully understand how, when you come up north, you can buy a lot more land for a lot less comparatively between the two. Right.
Yep.
But I do think it deserves some like attention of, where are we putting all this? Like, what is it going to? It's a great program. It's done incredible things for the state. But does it make sense to keep putting it in like one area or not? I don't really know. And I don't know that BHA will ever have an opinion on that. I can have my own on that stuff too. But like, yeah, maybe like 150 acres in Dane County would sometimes make more sense than 400 acres in forest or something, right? Like,
in terms of like a usage. Yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah. If we want to grow these activities, if we want to grow our group, part of that consideration has to be where we're putting access. And like, because it is hard. Like, if you're brand new to something, and you're like, well, there's a ton of land. If I go up to Rusk County or Chippewa County, I can hunt here, I can do this here, do that. Well, you got a trip. Are you going to camp or are you going to stay in a hotel? Like, do you have a camper? Do you have a tent? Like, all of a sudden the cost really starts to rile up. And is that, you know, serving as like a disincentive for people to get involved? I don't know. Like, but I'm just curious sometimes as far as like proximity to like population centers for some of these, I think is something that deserves more attention when they're deciding what they're buying. So you can't just say like, well, we spent all the money, we did what we were supposed to do. Like, I want it to be like more intentional sometimes. Like,
for sure.
Where are you gonna create like the highest ROI? Where are you gonna create the best amount of access for the most amount of people for it to be well used and well appreciated? Like, I hear from people up here too that are like, I love it. I can hike in the Schwamigan or, you know, this county land or this, you know, Knowles Nelson piece for hours and not see a single person. And that's cool. Like, I love the solitude too. But like, shouldn't more people be able to get out there and kind of have similar experiences? Right.
Right. Like, yeah, it's a delicate balance, man. And like you said, that ROI thing it's a really tough, happy medium to find. Right.
Yeah.
That was one of the thoughts that I'd had after the last time you and I spoke, was just like, you know, a lot of these prairie projects, these pollinator projects or, you know, stuff like that, they're done in maybe 80 acre chunks right outside of a suburb or something like that with a dog walking trail or a biking trail through it. And it's like, that's awesome. We've got a good pollinator blend here. People are going to use that. However, what animals are living there? You know what I mean? Are we creating good deer habitat? Are we like, we're not going to have prairie chickens all of a sudden sprouting up in here, or quail or pheasant, you know what I mean? Stuff like that. So it's kind of like, okay, well, that's great because people are going to be able to use it because it's right outside their back door. But at the same time, like where the wildlife are going to use it is in those more rural areas and stuff.
Yeah.
So it's a,
and that's the thing too. And I think that kind of goes back to these combined interests of having to have these environmental considerations on top of conservation, you know, because I do think they're different. I think they overlap a ton, but I think there's a distinct difference between the two as well in their interests. And, you know, like, I'm never going to say, well, we shouldn't do any habitat restoration and things for, you know, pollinators and wildlife outside of suburbs. But like, you're never going to be able to take a 12 gauge and hunt there. Right. Like,
right.
Nor should you probably. I mean, I don't know if you can look out at your back window and see somebody that you don't know just chasing animals. Like, I don't know that's ever going to be approved.
Yeah,
but again, like, yeah, where are we? You know, where are we putting some of this stuff? Like, again, concept's great. It's proven and we know it. It's a good conservation model. But the intention behind it too has to be like, not just checking a box saying, hey, we did this. You know, we were told to do this. We did it. Pat on the back. Did it help in the grand scheme of things when we zoom back out and look at the state? Are we, you know, realistically improving wildlife habitat and species, you know, numbers and all that stuff? So,
yeah.
They overlap, but they're different, right? And that's where like things get really finicky and you have to kind of finesse things. So
yeah, definitely, man. Gosh, that almost triggered me into going off on a rant about urban archery opportunities. But
I will leave
that and those cocky Morton Arboretum. Not Morton Arboretum. Isn't the Morton Arboretum, right? Is that in Madison? Morton Arboretum might be where I went to college. Never mind. I'm sitting here. The
isn't it just called the Madison Arboretum?
Madison Arboretum. Those damn turkeys in there, dude.
The cockiest
sons of guns anyone's ever seen. They'll steal your children. Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah.
We used to, I used to be a fireman in Madison, and we would have like what we call the street turkey. And it was always funny around like Thanksgiving and stuff because these things are like living off of like grass clippings and trash, like they're almost like raccoons, you know what I mean?
But
then you'd see like 30 of them just running down like a busy city of Madison street because they knew they were good. It's like, man, how did you learn so fast?
Right? I don't know. We need to maybe put like a one day urban, like metropolitan turkey hunt or something like that. Open up the arboretums, all that sort of stuff.
A lot of states have programs like that. Like you can hunt in some really dense like areas with archery, you know, like, and seems to work. I don't know. I feel like it would be all over the news if people were catching like stray broadheads and stuff, but
exactly. Yeah. Somebody's Shih Tzu took an arrow or something like that. I don't think that's anything that we have to worry about. But all right. Before we get too off track there, one of the questions I had, I get fired up about the urban hunting opportunities, man.
I like it.
So one of the things that I want to touch on here too, is just in terms of like, you know, how does the BHA collaborate with the DNR, communicate with the DNR, with legislation and stuff like that in terms of, you know, seeing, I guess, voicing their opinion on how things should be done, as well as, you know, maybe proposing new things or pushing back against certain things.
Yeah. So, we work a lot with the DNR and the executive branch in Wisconsin, and that ranges from, we do a ton with them with like R3 stuff, like our learn to hunts. We can't do any of that without them. But on the policy and like legislative side, you know, like part of my role here is I'm part of the, I think we're doing them like quarterly now, where we meet with the DNR executive staff and have these like round tables. And that was started under Secretary Payne. I'm hoping they continue now with the new appointee. But, you know, it was a good opportunity because, like, I'd be sitting there next to a guy who's representing the commercial fishing groups for Lake Michigan. You know, and he's got his list of stuff that he wants to see done.
Yep.
And I'm sitting here, and then there's the Audubon Society and, you know, all these other groups. So they definitely hear us out, and they give us an opportunity to come meet with everybody else too and try to like walk through some of this stuff. Now, my one pitch I'm going to make in here though for listeners is like, please join a group that you're interested in and like get involved, because like that whole coalition is great. I'm not saying anybody's incapable of being there or whatever, but there's going to come a time where we need younger people to be able to like fill in these spots. Right. And that's evident when I do a lot of these coalition things where they even talk about like the youth is a concern for them. Like that kind of like, I would say even under 50 crowd, they would love to get more involved in taking like an active role in these things, mm-hmm. To make sure they continue on. Right. So we do that. I'm part of the like CWD review. I can't remember what that work group's called, but
yeah,
we're just talking about like redoing the master plan on that, I guess. You know, they reach out basically anytime they're starting some kind of new work group, we're on their list, we get involved. So it's everything from just general DNR activity to CWD and deer populations to fishing and all that stuff too. So definitely have a seat at the table. Typically the governor's office will reach out before budget stuff comes up to see like what our wish list of sorts is. Didn't get that call this year, but we have in the past, and we've talked through some stuff about what we think would provide, again, like the most opportunity and highest ROI that we'd like to see buy-in from the governor and the legislature itself and the DNR. But yeah, and then with the legislature, you know, a lot of that comes down to like just engaging who represents you, you know, cause like yeah. I can lobby and do stuff with people and, you know, try to move the needle on things. Like I have better relationships with some than others, which is great. Cause it can really talk through some of the issues and what they're facing politically too, which is, you know, a whole separate thing of, again, what we think looks best versus what's possible and finding something in the middle there. And then part of like, you know, just being like a grassroots organization is with the Sandhill Crane thing. When it was still in committee before it got recommended out for consideration in the legislature as a whole, you know, we really wanted to make sure that the committee knew that a lot of people cared about this. So we sent out some links for like social media and to our email list and to all of our members with a petition form. And it sounds super old school or irrelevant, and people probably get sick of signing their name on stuff. But it carried a lot of weight in that committee when one of the members, you know, had a stack of, you know, 2,000 petitions that were sent just to his office saying we should do this. So like your voice is, you have a vote, like you can get involved. And it's easier to know what those things are when you're part of groups or if you're plugged in or on these email lists, because that's how we disseminate most of them, right? Like mm-hmm. Same with the Pine Nights coming up. Part of that whole thing will be afterwards, if you're on board and you think that we've got a good plan on Sandhill Cranes, you'll be able to scan a QR code, sign a, you know, put your name and whatever, and it'll instantly send that off to like your legislator, voicing your support for this for when it comes to a vote. So
yeah,
it's a great, that's the easiest, best way to do it, is just showing like if you have overwhelming support for something, they're always going to listen.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and that's another thing too, like I'll plug this again, I plugged it in last week's episode too, but BHA makes it so unbelievably easy to make your voice heard by going to that take action tab, selecting your state. You guys have pre-curated or pre-selected, you know, whatever bills or opportunities are pertinent to your state. All you have to do is click on that. You can proofread the email that it's going to send, put in your name and address and click submit, and it'll send the email straight to whoever your correct representative is. Like it yep. could not be easier. I got an automatic reply from one yesterday about the Sandhill Crane issue and all that sort of stuff. And so it literally could not be easier for folks getting involved. So yeah, folks definitely go and do that. you know, I wanted to touch on the roundtable discussions you mentioned there too, and all the different advocacy groups. You suggested that folks get involved with a group that they're interested in. One of the things we talked about with Sam Soholt last week was the difference between conservation groups and advocacy groups. How do those, you know, maybe the conservation groups like Trout Unlimited or NDA or, you know, whatever they may be. We've got, even got like Wisconsin Waterfowl Association, stuff like that. How did those groups that are maybe on the conservation side of things, more so than the advocacy side of things, how did those guys show up to those meetings in terms of making their voices heard?
Yeah. So at the round table, everybody's there. So it's all the environmental groups too. And I don't always like framing it that way, 'cause like we are too, just in a different way, I guess. You know, conservation is different than preservation. And I'm sure like you've talked about that with other guests before too. Like we aren't just trying to see like land preserved for all of time to be left alone. Like we want species to be healthy and that land to be thriving as habitat so we can pursue fish and game on it. And because we care about the environment, like we want clean air, we want clean water. You know, these are all normal things for us, but at these roundtables, like they are involved in, and you know, there's times where we're on very opposite ends of things. Like sometimes the groups there, like I said, with the Sandhill Cranes, there's the Crane Foundation and some of those groups that are like, absolutely not. Mm-hmm. And we're civil and in the same room and we're saying, yeah, it's time. Like, this is what the model is. This is like our constitutional right in Wisconsin is to be able to hunt and fish game that is at a safe and manageable, you know, count, and we're going to support it, right? Like it makes sense to us. That's our version of conservation because it's been proven time and time again. You can look at it with some of the groups are trying to get rid of like sturgeon spearing, and that was more of a federal issue, but we still chimed in and said, no, we're good. We're the model here. Like Wisconsin's done an exceptional job of managing our sturgeon count and our habitat for them. You can't take that away because another state is having an issue. Like we're good here. Like maybe they should come here and learn how we did all these things. You know, and even on like the wolf issue, like we have our stance on that. There's a lot of people who have a very different stance, you know, as like an absolutely not. You know, we're there to again find that middle, which is good that they take into account all those sides. Mm-hmm. You know, into consideration for making like big decisions, right? But again, like we're there and a lot of these other, you know, like more hunting and fishing conservation groups, we're generally more aligned with just because we see the value and like our heritage and all these other things that coincide with that. But we're not going to say like, yeah, we don't want clean air. Like, no, we
right.
want clean air too. Like, but we want to mm-hmm. be able to hunt and fish in that clean air.
Yeah.
And that's the big thing that drives BHA specifically, but we have a ton of overlap with those other hunting and fishing groups because we're there for the same reason. And they might represent really specific things like, you know, NDA focuses on deer and Trout Unlimited focuses on trout fishing. Right.
For sure.
We focus on public lands for hunting and fishing, right? Like access to pursue game. But everybody's got a seat at the table. And they, you know, it's been interesting to hear some of their like concerns and like opinion on the side too, and stuff that we should consider moving forward. But again, like we're there to advocate for our members and mm-hmm. what we see as like the appropriate model to follow.
Yeah, absolutely. How much easier is it? That, this might be a loaded way of asking a question. Is it, let me put it this way. Is it easier to, from a governmental standpoint, is it easier for hunting opportunities to be restricted or expanded?
Oh, both.
Okay.
Yeah. 'Cause it's going to depend. Like, I mean, getting the Sandhill hunt, if it ever comes to fruition, that's a heck of a process. Mm-hmm. You have to get sign off from so many people. The restriction side though is complicated too, because, well, like if anything gets endangered, it's pretty, I don't want to say easy, but it's, expedited to prove that the population is struggling, right? They can really pull restrictions that way, but that's typically federal coming in and being like, hey, you know, you're about to wipe out this species. But then like, all right, we'll dive into the wolf hunt because I know everybody's dying to hear it, right? You can delist things. So like President Trump delisted the wolf during his first term, the Great Wolf, the Great Lakes Great Wolf. But that could be rescinded quickly. And then like courts get involved and judges have a say, and you know, the Fifth Circuit and, you know, judges in states far, far away from the Great Lakes were making rulings over if this was like constitutional or not, if they had the authority to do so. If other groups started suing to, you know, provide like an injunction and delay it, basically, you know, it's a whole thing. So then it has to actually go through the House and the Senate to the president's desk. Like, so the Western wolf is huntable because it's a different bill that was signed. That's why you can go to Montana and Idaho and wherever, and you can, they have seasons, or like you go to Utah and you just, or Idaho, and you just hunt them year round, right? But it's different class of what the wolf is. So here, you know, there's some congressmen like in Wisconsin too, like Congressman Tiffany's been circulating a bill to delist the Great Lakes wolf from the protected list. And then it's got to get through the House, it's got to get through the Senate, and then it's got to get, you know, signed off by whoever the president is. And that's its whole other game, right? So it's a little bit of both. Like, once something is like not on the list to hunt, you have to do a lot of work to get it back on. And even though we're a constitutional like hunt and fish state, there's still barriers and there's lawsuits and there's, you know, studies and more studies on that study and, you know, a lot of things that go into it. I would say pulling back though, you'll get like public uproar, you know, if you come in and say you can't do this anymore, or if you make a change to like bag limits or whatever. Like if you're just restricting quantity, it's maybe a little easier, but if you're restricting like pursuit itself of something, there's going to be some like uproar, and you better have something there that shows that it needs to be protected.
For sure. Yeah, no, what came to mind was obviously the, you know, the wolf thing's big. The Sandhill Crane Hunt's been a project for, I mean, I think when I talked to Pat Durkin, it was like 97 was like the first time that he wrote about it. Like it's been around for,
I was writing about it back then. Yeah.
Yeah. It's been around forever and we're still working on this stuff. But then you have things like, and I know this is more a management style restriction than it is a hunting opportunity restriction. But then it seemed like we all remember when Ernebuck was written out of law, and it's now we're no longer able to use that as a deer management tactic and stuff like that. And so like, that's something that seemed like it happened on a fairly short term time frame, but I wasn't sure, you know, obviously.
Yeah. And I think again, the difference there, Pierce, is just like, you're not saying you can't do something. You're just saying you have to like do it differently.
A certain way. Got it. Yeah. That makes sense.
I think those things are a little faster and they're still going to have pushback and, you know, the court of public opinion is going to find you, but it's still something you could do in like one legislative cycle.
Yeah.
But as far as like something brand new or some like drastic change, they're going to punt as much as they can.
For sure.
As long as they can, because of those competing sides, right? Like either one group's going to be filing appeals and doing everything they can to stop it, and the other group is fighting like heck trying to get it to go through. And it, because you have those forces going against each other, it's just friction, you know, over time for it to get across. So
yeah,
it's so hit or miss, you know, sometimes it can go really fast. Sometimes it's years and years. You
know? Yeah. Like, no, that makes sense, man. Well, man, we're coming up on an hour here. So I want to touch on just a couple more things here before we wrap up. So real quick, could you recap some of just like the biggest project areas or areas of focus that BHA is working on right now? And then after that, I want to hear a little bit about the recently published proposal for the fee increase for our licenses.
Got it. Yeah, so BHA, always across the board, we're going to be supporting more access to public land opportunities to pursue fish and game. We're always trying to figure out the best way to do that. We take feedback from people across the state. If they have like local issues that we can engage on, we're going to engage on them. Can't be in all 72 counties at once as much as I would love to, but so keep those coming too. We're working hard on the trying to find a final solution on the Sandhill Crane Hunt to have a manageable, repeatable, ethical hunting season for that. And then kind of like our long-term is how do we create more access on our own, partnering with other groups to purchase easements or to purchase land itself? And how do we fundraise the right way to do those things in areas that we think need more access? Or like we talked about with the landlocked pieces that are throughout the state, you know, how do we get in there without a helicopter or without getting permission from somebody that may or may not give us permission to get back there? So those are kind of like our big areas, and the list goes on and on. Like we're going to engage on all kinds of stuff that, you know, makes sense to us, and it's going to grow our sports and the things that we love. So yeah, if you want to get involved, and if you're curious about the landlock thing, Onyx released a report on that you can find online. I think it's still published on their site, but you can find pretty much how much land in Wisconsin is borderline inaccessible unless you know somebody that knows somebody. Mm-hmm. So I would love to get that figured out because we already have it. It's going to take a little bit of new money probably, but there's got to be a way to unlock like literally thousands of acres of land.
Right. Absolutely. That we would, I mean, as public land guys, you got to imagine that a landlocked chunk of private surround or a chunk of public surrounded by a bunch of private, like there's got to be good opportunity in there. There's got to be some crusty old 192 inch slammer that's just been living it up back there.
You know what I mean? Like, I'll come clear it.
Right. Exactly. So in terms of issues that, you know, folks listening right now should be aware of and stuff that should be on their radar and all that, we've got Sandhill Crane Hunt and all that sort of stuff, accessing our own lands and stuff like that. But then recently you'd mentioned the fee increase for our licenses.
Yeah.
How would that affect folks listening?
It's going to cost you more money. Mm-hmm. To do basically everything. It was across the board, specific increases for different species. And they did mirror the increase for non-residents, which we've had a non-resident increase in the past. I would have liked to have seen this one be larger than it was if we're going to mm-hmm. raise the rate on our residents too. And like ultimately, Pierce, what was a little disappointing for myself, and I guess I'll say BHA as a whole, because we signed on to a letter this past fall. You know, we recognize that like capital costs and cost of doing business are going up, and you know, there hasn't been a fee increase for a long time. However, we worked with other groups and we worked with the legislators to say, okay, we have a shortfall in fish and wildlife account. Like the deficit is coming. It's not right now for everybody listening. Like they have the money now, but it's coming down the road. So they're trying to fix that. And that's probably where all this is coming. I haven't seen the like expected models or revenue generated from this. Like you could go do basic math and just assume if you have the same amount of users as last year, just, you know, multiply it by two or whatever, and you might get close, but you're going to lose a number of people that aren't going to do this now because it's going to cost more. So we don't really know what that looks like. I'd like to see the model, but ultimately, like I was mentioning before, you know, we signed on and we talked a lot as a board about, hey, we'll have this discussion, but first, if this account is, you know, so beaten and battered, and if it took, you know, $25 million from the forestry account a few years ago to get it above water again, can we audit it? Like, can we just see where the money is being spent? And we're not insinuating like malicious intent by anybody. And some people are completely overblown by it, but it's just one of those things of like, if we're going to grant a lot of new money on the backs of the users who already contribute through Pittman Robinson, who already contribute through Sportfish and taxes and everything else, let's make sure we're like spending this the right way, you know, not just spending it, but like, where are we spending our time and resources of this specific account and the money that we generate to use it before we have a conversation about anything else? And people have talked before about backpack tax and non-motorized taxes and these other things for users. And like, personally, I would just like to see the report first and be like, okay, like I can work with this. You know, we can dive through this and see what makes the most sense. Because like, does it make the most sense that $20 be added to people that only deer hunt, but $20 also gets added for people that have small game licenses or somebody that just fishes, never hunts? Like, are these things equal? Right. Like, but we don't know because we don't have the results of that yet. So we weren't saying we weren't going to support one in the future. It's just, we wanted a process before we got there. Right. Like, you're not just going to blanket like, well, it's been 10 years, like time for a raise. Like, nobody does that. You have to validate your work and, you know, really show the need for more. You can't just say you need more. Like, we just want to see what's the plan, you know, like where's the money coming from? Where does it go? Who's generating the most? Like, where can we make this kind of all make sense in like an equitable, like, you know, realistic way? So, not surprised that it came out. I guess I'm kind of bummed, you know, like, cause it was a shock. Like, I had to plug my phone in pretty early yesterday after that came out because I was getting calls and texts and emails and all this other stuff saying like, have you seen this? And it's like, yeah, I've seen it. I'm looking at it. you know, I get the money scarce and, you know, costs of doing business are going up. It's just one of those things where it's like, hey, we signed on to this audit. We requested it. I know it's kind of a pain in the butt for everybody, but like, that's part of government is transparency and accountability and, you know, trying to refine it to be more efficient and work better for its primary users, right? Not just for making an account balance, but how is this working for Wisconsin's, you know, hunters and anglers?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, man. Yeah, it's one of those things. It seems like we'd be able to solve it easily, but when you factor in how many moving parts there are and how many groups are affected by it and the ramifications of it, you know, if you were to just do a $20 increase on your deer license or whatever it may be, you know, on top of that.
Yeah. Even on social media, I was seeing people being like, you know, they raised some good points. Cause they're like, now you're just going to have people, you know, I don't want to say poaching, but they're going to hunt or fish and then maybe buy a license after they have success. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, maybe, I don't know. Like,
yeah.
Cause it is a big jump. Like, I'm a big incremental guy and that's not like a BHA policy. Right. But I just like gradual things that make sense, but not like a, 100% increase. Like with the release of a statement, it's like, oh, like going for it here. But again, that's not BHA. That's just me seeing like a substantial raise. And again, it's still affordable for most people. And it's important to remember that like not everybody has the same means, right? Like, this stuff starts adding up, just like we were talking about with access. You have to get all the stuff. Ammunition's up and taxes up and this is up and gas to go somewhere is up. And if you want to buy a tent, well, that costs double what it cost 3 years ago. You know, like it compounds itself. So we have to like take into account of not just like pushing or you know, dampening our tradition and all this other stuff just to try to make an account balance overnight.
Right.
You know, like just be intentional about what we're doing with it.
Mm-hmm.
It may be that we need to find new sources and it might require fee increases on some things too. And again, I know we're affordable, but we're like on the resident side, we are comparable to like most Midwest states.
Yep.
Non-resident side, we are cheap, I'll say.
Mm-hmm.
For how good it is to recreate here, like it's pretty dang good deal for a lot of people to come here. And I know everybody listening has seen license plates from all over the lower 48.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? Well, dude, I had no idea either. I think like a couple of years ago, a report came out talking about for like hunting for like the gun season. I think it was just the gun season. Maybe it was the whole deer season. But there were licenses sold to people from all 50 states and like 16 countries.
What?
Think about that.
Holy smokes.
Canada's easy, right? Yeah. So you're like one. Okay. Yeah.
No way.
Yeah. We have a great thing here. Yeah. Again, it's important for people to remember, like, we have a, this is a rocking place to be able to hunt and fish. We've got to keep it that way. But, you know, who pays for what and where the burden mm-hmm. of all that goes is where we have to really figure things out. Cause it's
right.
I'm pretty sure it was 16. It was at least a dozen. Cause I remember reading that being like,
that is wild, man. I would love to see what the split is for some other states, like neighboring states and stuff. Like even like, I'd love to see like Iowa non-resident deer. Like,
well, I don't know. You have limited access though.
Limited access, crazy expensive non-resident tag. Yeah. You got to apply for multiple years. Like how many like international folks are doing that? Whereas, so is it just a matter of, but like, I don't know. You look at the, circling back to the opportunity thing, like we've got how many top 10 Boone and Crockett counties in Wisconsin?
Yeah. Like, and like 18% of our land is publicly accessible.
Exactly.
Like, pretty good ratio.
Right. Plus, I mean, a sub $200 non-resident tag. I mean, it's kind of a no brainer. Like if you're somebody looking for a good whitetail opportunity, like especially when you want to hunt, you know, everybody, you know, I don't want to keep harping on Iowa, but everybody, you know, starts thinking about big buck states and stuff like that. It's like, well, maybe I'll just go next door. Like, why wouldn't I? Makes sense. Like the genetics can't be that different.
A lot of the texts and calls I got yesterday were even talking about like how much it costs to like hunt ducks in wherever, like somewhere down south, or you know, if you want to hunt mule deer in Montana, and if you want to hunt, you know, elk in Colorado, whatever it is, right? Like everybody knows those. Like if you're in that category where you travel to hunt, you know what it costs in like all these other states.
Yeah.
What it's going to cost you to go to hunt Kansas or Missouri or wherever. If there's like, what was concerning for a lot of them was the disparity on that non-resident side. Cause they're like, hey, I'm going to this other person's state, but that's my choice and I'm paying for it. You know what I mean? Like, and they don't flinch. You can still go do it.
Mm-hmm.
So like, you know, maybe we are still too cheap on the non-resident side. I don't know.
Yeah.
At some point it's a, you know, the curve loses its steam because you're going to be too expensive that less and less and less people are going to be coming. And then maybe you throw that balance out of whack. But
right.
I don't know that would happen that fast because it is pretty good here.
Right. Exactly. Well, even, I mean, you just look south, Illinois has got $360 tag, something like that, something around there. Like, and that, I mean, people don't bat an eye at that.
Nope.
So, you know, obviously, yeah, like you said, you could find that sweet spot, but it'd be curious to see from a resident side of things too. You take some of those non-resident guys out. What's your hunting season look like?
Yeah.
This fall. You know what I mean? Like, are you seeing more deer?
Does it get pressure? Better?
Does it? You know, exactly. Yeah.
Good question.
Yeah. Maybe. I don't know. It's interesting, man. But yeah. And especially too, like you said, it's tough to balance, you know, or I guess justify the same increase across the board for everything. You know what I mean? Cause
I think they can get upset was like, this doesn't seem right. Or like, it was just like the easy thing, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. It goes back to just being like intentional with all this. It's just like, let's figure this out. Like
Right. Well, it's, I mean, like managing anything though, it's there are very few things that are solvable with a blanket solution. Right.
Yeah.
It's, you need to be intentional and you need to be specific and calculated in what you're doing. And unfortunately that takes a lot of time and resources. And so,
and a little patience.
Yep. Exactly. Yeah. But well, man, I think we've before we get on too much of a tangent there, I think we've touched on a lot of really great stuff here today, just to give people a picture of kind of how things work here in our state and what the biggest projects really are on the radar. Last but not least, like, so folks, if you're looking to get in touch with your state representatives, you can find that information through the BHA Take Action tab. That's a good way to voice your opinion and stuff on a specific level. But when it comes to actually like finding your local state representative and getting in touch with them about maybe other stuff or getting involved in other ways, where would you point people?
Oh, just straight to the like legislative websites. That'll give you the easy idea. You can just punch in your address and it'll pull up who your rep is or play the game on the map of what district you're in and stuff. But yeah.
Got it. And then folks looking to get involved with BHA, backcountryhunters.org/Wisconsin, backcountryhunters.org/join if you're looking to join, if you're not a member yet. But Paul, this has been awesome, man. I'm looking forward to our next update in a couple months here when hopefully we'll see. I mean, that'll be post spring hearing, so we should have plenty to talk about then and just see what kind of things
to talk about. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely, man. But dude, I appreciate the heck out of your time, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Pierce. It was a pleasure.
That's all for this week's episode. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you like this episode, be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're at it, if you could leave me a 5-star review, I would appreciate that a ton. You can also follow along with my outdoor adventures on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube at The Wisconsin Sportsman. That's also the best way to get a hold of me to suggest topics, guests, or questions you'd like me to explore on this show. Big thanks to our awesome partners XOP, Onyx, Huntworth, Good Chance Fly Fishing, and the Wisconsin chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. Please go support the brands and support this show. And if you're looking for more awesome outdoor content, go check out thesportsmansempire.com, where you'll find a ton of other outdoor podcasts. And until next time, make sure you make the time to get outside and enjoy the incredible natural resources that are ours as Wisconsin sportsmen.
I saw this app.
I got a hit.
In the new limited series, DTF St. Louis, Jason Bateman, David Harbour, and Linda Cardellini star as three suburbanites who spice up their love lives.
Wow.
Don't miss the new HBO original limited series, DTF St. Louis, premiering March 1st on HBO Max.
Where's your playlist taking you? Down the highway? To the mountains? Or just into daydream mode while you're stuck in traffic? With over 4,000 hotels worldwide, Best Western is there to help you make the most of your getaway. Wherever that is. Because the only thing better than a great playlist is a great trip. Life's the trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
This episode is brought to you by Peloton. Break through the busiest time of year with the brand new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus. Powered by Peloton IQ. With real-time guidance and endless ways to move, you can personalize your workouts and train with confidence. Helping you reach your goals in less time. Let yourself run, lift, sculpt, push, and go. Explore the new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus at onepeloton.com.
President's Day savings are happening now at the Home Depot with up to 40% off select appliances. Looking to upgrade your fridge? Check out LG's newest model, serving up ice in all kinds of styles. Cube, crushed, craft ice, and now new mini craft ice straight from the dispenser. From cold brew to fizzy favorites, these refrigerators will have you entertaining like a pro. Shop President's Day savings and get up to 40% off, plus free delivery on select appliances like LG at the Home Depot. Free delivery on appliance purchases of $1,498 or more. Offer valid February 5th through the 25th, U.S. only. See store online for details.
The world moves fast. Your workday, even faster. Pitching products, drafting reports, analyzing data. Microsoft 365 Copilot is your AI assistant for work. Built into Word, Excel, PowerPoint, and other Microsoft 365 apps you use. Helping you quickly write, analyze, create, and summarize. So you can cut through clutter and clear a path to your best work. Learn more at Microsoft.com/M365 Copilot.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.